Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
There's always one. There was Red Hill Creek, or there was the stadium, or there was LRT. Still is LRT, I suppose. This council, it's encampments. This seems to be the issue that is tying council up in knots and tying the city up in knots, quite honestly. And now council has put forward a survey of sorts. It's not a very long one, but it's a survey of sorts asking you for your opinion on what should happen with encampments and protocols. Things like, are you in favor of sanctioned encampment sites? If the city was to allow for sanctioned encampment sites, what things would you like to see the city prioritize when implementing this approach? Things like that. John Paul Danko is the councillor for Ward 8. He has spoken about this issue many times on council and here on the show. Joins us now. Councillor, how are you today?
I'm good, Scott.
This, some people may say, and I'm sure you've probably already heard this, some people may say this is council copping out, trying to pass the buck and get the citizens to come up with an answer that councillors should be coming up with. Is that a reasonable comment?
I think in your introduction, you laid out the issue before us pretty well, that homelessness, addictions, and mental health issues are skyrocketing in our community. And in particular, just coming out of the COVID pandemic, the housing affordability is so out of reach for the average Hamiltonian, whether it's ownership or rental, that it's compounded all these other issues. And I think council is taking definitive steps to address housing affordability, homelessness, addictions, and mental health. We're spending just over $70 million this year on programs to support homelessness and housing. And, you know, we're adding hundreds of new spaces to supportive housing. We have all kinds of programs. We're spending hundreds of staff hours every day on this issue. But the reality is that those factors are in a crisis in our city, and we have an obligation to residents to come up with better solutions that are there now. The fact is that encampments and homelessness exist in our communities, and we need to find out, what residents think are the best ways to deal with those problems.
I will point out, and there's a reason why, as I read this, so let me just read a line from the city's survey that's out. In 2023, the Ontario Superior Court of Justice ruled that municipalities need to have places for people experiencing homelessness to go, such as shelters or other housing solutions, before asking individuals to leave encampments. So that's positioning why I assume on this survey there is no box to check to say, I'm okay with encampments, I support sanctioned encampments, or I don't want encampments. The third one is not there. I'm assuming that's the reason it's not there.
I think there's some complexities to the interpretation of that legal ruling. My understanding is that was specific to a city parking lot, not city parks. So there are different ways of interpreting that. And I think, in the survey, we're asking residents for their opinion on two separate issues. Number one, do you support or favor a sanctioned encampment program? That would be 20 to 50 tents somewhere on a city property. They might include supports such as toilets or water. It would include security and social services. And if you were okay with that, where would that go? Where do you think would be an appropriate location for 20 to 50 tents? And it would have to be somewhere on city property. And then the second part of that is on the encampment protocol, which is a little bit different but related. And that's kind of when somebody shows up in a park, sets up a tent, should we allow people to camp overnight in a tent in a park or city property, up to five tents with some controls in place? And we want to know from residents what those controls would be. Would it, for issues such as drug use and needles or illegal activity or aggressive and violent behavior, what would be appropriate if we were to allow that? So those are the two things that we want to hear from residents. And I think, to your question, could we just say no? I think that is an option that residents are certainly going to articulate. But if that is the answer, then you know, we need other solutions. Because again, the reality is that homelessness and mental health and addictions exist, and encampments are going to continue to exist.
And the nuance and the difficulty of this is that here's what I expect is probably going to happen now. Because people don't have an option to say, I am not in favor of encampments, period, people are going to vote. But if you can't answer that, but that's your feeling, you may not fill out the survey. So this is then going to come back to city council, and someone is going to say, look, the majority of the people in the city support sanctioned encampments, even though the majority probably would have checked a third box if they'd had that opportunity on this thing. So it's going to create, I expect it's going to create this sort of false narrative when this thing comes in front of council about what people really want.
Well, the survey, the city survey does have two distinct options, yes, no, A or B, black and white. So you could answer yes or no to either of those questions. But, again, the nuance of the conversation is that the encampments are going to continue to exist. We're trying to have, more public engagement from the wider public. The Mountain Wards, councillors Jackson, Councillor Pauls, Councillor Spadafore, Councillor Tattison, and Councillor Clark and I are hosting a Mountain engagement session, a public town hall, on June the 19th, from 7 o'clock until 9 p.m. at the Hill Park Auditorium, and I think that's where we'd like to hear from residents in person. And it's a bit different from filling out a survey to having that discussion in a public forum in person. And we're hoping to hear from as many residents across the mountain as possible to hear what their experience is in their neighborhood and what their positions are on what we should do as a city.
One more thing before I let you go, because we could talk about this for hours, but we're short on time. Do you anticipate, I think when people fill out this survey, the other thing, and you've already alluded to it, is what do you think about where perhaps should encampments go? I find it very hard to believe that many people are going to say, next door to my house, please. It's all going to be somewhere else. And if you have a bunch of people from Ward 8 or whoever else has it from their ward, and they all say elsewhere, is that just going to be portrayed then that you have a bunch of uncaring people in Ward 8 or forever, whoever else is counselor says the same thing? Is that the interpretation that's going to come from that?
I don't think so. And I think we hear that from all across the city. So if everyone across the city is saying, well, I might support this, but I definitely don't want it in my neighborhood park, it would not be fair for us as a council to then impose that on somebody's neighborhood park. So I think that is a consideration. And this is a citywide issue. This is not an issue that's just affecting one area of the city. It's not just downtown. It affects all of us. And it affects, residents and businesses and those that are visiting our city. And we're not the only city dealing with this.
No.
This is impacting cities across Canada, across North America.
No, it is. It is absolutely all over the place. And I know I that meeting or those meetings are going to be fascinating, because I have a feeling that there will be a lot of people with a lot to say. There always is on this issue. Councillor John Paul Danko, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Sitting next to me, a man who probably does, don't give the answer, but do you know the line?
Yes.
Yes. Lauren King is a professor at Wilfrid Laurier University, but that's not why he's in here. There are a lot of professors. There are very few professors who swim across endlessly long bodies of water. A few years ago, I met Lauren when he had just swam the English Channel. I think it's swam the English Channel. And just last month, Lauren was back in the water swimming the Cook Strait between the North and South Island of New Zealand. And I got to tell you, Lauren, none of this sounds fun.
it's amazing the length some of us will go to avoid work.
Do you find it fun? Because to me, it sounds horrible.
Yeah, it's odd. When I did the English Channel, the last time we spoke, it kind of freaked me out a bit, because the thing that got me across was the thought. I think we mentioned and talked about it 9 hours, where things got kind of miserable. And I thought, I'm never doing this again. So I'll just finish this.
Yeah.
And that's it. we're done.
No exercise ever again.
Certainly not in the water. And I think that freaked me out a little bit because, honestly, for a few hours, that was what was keeping me going, the thought that, look, this is the most ridiculous hobby, and take up golf or something.
Is it miserable, though? Is it miserable?
It's certainly – there are things about some of those swims that, are really challenging. I mean, there's an old saying especially among the English Channel crowd that 80% of this is in your head. Now, that other 20% is pretty important, but they're not wrong. I mean, it's a mental struggle, right? There are a lot of really strong swimmers who I think would probably get in and after a few hours say, this is stupid, why am I here, right? Whereas there are a lot of people who, you wouldn't look and say, that's an Olympian swimmer, but they're good swimmers, they're strong swimmers, and their head's in that place where they can just push through what sometimes is a pretty miserable experience.
I mean, there are other ultra sports, obviously. There's ultra running, whatever. Is this different? It seems different to me. You do have a crew there, right? You haven't just set out to cross, and you're not going to drown in the middle of the...
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it seems to me vastly different from running the same length of time.
Yeah, although I would say the ultra marathoners are sort of our kindred, spirits, that they are to marathon runs what we are to even long pool swims.
Yeah.
But it is a different exercise. Certainly, the way we structure it as a team, and we have, in so many of these, especially these iconic historic swims, a lot of them are in busy shipping lanes. So we need an escort mm-hmm. boat that can protect us from larger craft and that know the waters. And we sort of have someone in a boat, in a smaller boat beside us, often throwing us a bottle with food every half hour or so. You can't be touched. No intentional assistive contact is the usual rule. But as a good friend and author of the book Solo But Never Alone always says, right, that's the point. It's a solo swim, but it's really a team effort. You're doing your part in the water, but it would be really difficult to do without that team.
There's a guy from Hamilton. He went to Westmount, named Rob Krar, who is a world-class ultra-marathoner. He's got the world record for, in the Grand Canyon, the rim to rim. And like these things that are just crazy. And when I've talked to him, one of the things he says is it doesn't take long, and he kind of goes into a dark spot inwardly. What when you're spending seven and a half or nine hours, what are you thinking about? Because that's all you can do is think, right?
Well, I'll tell you what's going to be going through my head next swim is that Bloody Flintstones theme song.
Well, that's good. That's good for 9 hours. Yeah. As long as it's not, it's a small world. That's
even exactly.
Worse.
Yeah. But that's one of the things. Some people, some try to put together a kind of mental playlist of things that they'll sort of think about. I find I don't really succeed when I do that. Sometimes songs do get in my head for hours at a stretch, and I didn't want them there. I didn't mean for them to get there. And at other times, it's a bit more like you just described. You're just sort of
there,
right? It's almost meditative. And, that can be pleasant, but it can also be challenging, right? It's just staying in that space where you just, because if you start thinking too much, you start thinking about, look, there's a nice warm boat over there.
Yeah. It would almost be easier, more dangerous for sure, but it would almost be easier if you did this without a team.
Yep, yeah.
Because then you have to finish.
You got to finish,
there's
right?
There's no choice.
Yeah, yeah.
There's only
yeah.
two options, and if you don't finish, you don't finish.
Yeah, yeah.
But that lure, that temptation is right there.
Yeah, exactly. It's certainly a challenge just to deal with that component. Interestingly, in the history of swimming and... specifically in the United Kingdom, there's a great book called The Haunts of the Black Masseur about the history of marathon swimming. It's a curious book, but there were these romantic poets who would do exactly what you described. They would just jump in the ocean and swim, unassisted, unaccompanied, and to them that was sort of the purest form of this kind of reverie, right?
I guess.
But the flip side of that is Matthew Webb, who was the first swimmer across the English Channel, he's buried on the New York side of Niagara Falls, where he tried this unassisted dive in and swim across the whirlpool. And when they found his body hours later, he hadn't drowned. He had been pummeled by the sheer force of that water.
Well, you mentioned that because it seems to me that the English Channel is not exact. I mean, it's not a warm body of water. It's a shipping lane. All the places that seem to be the popular places for long distance swimmers seem very unforgiving. You don't hear of Caribbean swims.
Yeah. Although there are.
Are there?
Oh yeah. In fact, the current record for an unassisted ocean swim, Chloe McArdle, is a Grand Exuma in the Caribbean. It's like a vast ocean swim.
Is that because the water is warmer so you can do it longer?
I think you have to ask her, but I suspect there were different challenges. It's a different kind of challenge being in like warm salt water. It's exhausting. It heats up your body dangerously. Mm. The salt content reacts with your mouth and your system. It's another sort of challenge. But yeah, of these historic swims, I agree, a lot of them are these cold, unforgiving places. And
I was shocked when you told me this the other day. You don't wear a wetsuit.
We don't wear wetsuits. No, that's cheating.
So the water is like 15 or 16 degrees. How do you not get... I thought of this yesterday or the day before, whatever we talked, and I realized I never followed up with the question, but and it's in the paper. People can read it today. But how do you not get hypothermia?
I mean, to a degree... You kind of do get very mild hypothermia, and in very colder, in much colder waters, you know, you're learning to sort of what your body can handle in terms of generating heat from the food you're getting, from the pace you're keeping. But you know, at the end of the day, physics is always going to win, right? Your body is going to lose heat, and it's just a question of delaying that with a series of training tactics and you know, physical activity. But I mean, there are extraordinary feats of people who have stayed in that water swimming. I mean, Sarah Thomas, one of the most extraordinary swimmers on the planet, her four-way English Channel crossing in water that was probably in that 16-degree range, that's 57 hours in the water.
Yeah, let's not be indelicate here, because some of the people who have done very well at long-distance swims, who have been very famous around here, are larger bodies.
Yeah, definitely.
You are not large body.
Yeah.
You are not a heavy person.
Yes.
I would assume...
It's colder for me.
I would assume there actually would be an advantage to having some extra weight on.
There's a great advantage to it. In fact, there's an adage among the English Channel old-timers that you can't be too vain to gain. Even if you have the kind of physique that we have, it matters having what little body...
Have you tried?
Oh, yeah. I failed my first channel attempt.
No, but have you tried to put on that kind of weight?
Oh, yeah. You don't get much sympathy for saying, I just can't put on weight. But it is true that some of the most accomplished, formidably talented marathon swimmers in the world, yeah, they don't look like Michael Phelps and Katie Ledecky.
No, Vicky Keith,
yeah,
unbelievably successful, but when she was swimming, she was larger.
Enough body fat to fend off these very cold swims.
But wouldn't look necessarily like a world-class athlete. Yeah. I mean, you see what she does and you go, well, it's amazing.
There's a story about a famous Olympian who... thought he just, you know, because he's a very fast swimmer, was going to swim the English Channel and didn't last more than a few hours. And it was, you train for your event. And if you're going to spend, you know, 12, 15 hours in 15 degree water, you should look more like the kind of animals that swim in that water, right?
But you explain how you train to get used to the cold
water.
Yeah,
I was part of a group that we were helping a dear friend who's a very accomplished swimmer in the area, Madhu Nagaraja. He was going to swim the Straits of Magellan, which is obscenely cold. You're just swimming through the strait that's getting the Antarctic current right through it, right?
Lovely.
And the conditions are horrendous. My friends and I were assisting him. So we would swim... for, you know, 20 to 30 minutes in water that was anywhere from like 2 degrees.
In Lake Ontario.
Yeah, in Lake Ontario. It's not as if we innovated. It turns out there's been people doing this for a long time. And this idea of winter swimming has been around for a while. And it's now a little more popular here in the Great Lakes, and we have in the greater Toronto Hamilton area at least, I think we have two, three who lived here directly. Some have moved away. Ice milers, swimmers who have swum a mile in water that's below 5 degrees with nothing.
No wetsuit,
just cap goggles and nylon suit. And so I was involved in that for a while. These days, if it's really like below 10, I tend to just sit for half an hour in the water, just sort of chest to neck deep, and just try to sort of just get your body used to that feeling. And then as the water gets a little warmer, like 12, then we start doing some longer swims.
We're talking to Lauren King, who just finished doing the Cook Strait, swimming the Cook Strait, among others. He's a Hamilton guy, a Wilfrid Laurier professor. But at what point when you start does the thought first hit you? Because you're doing, as I say, 7 hours, 8 hours, 9 hours. At what point does the thought hit you, this really sucks?
Yeah.
Is it like right away when the water hits, or is it 2 hours or half? Or
again, it sort of depends on where your head is at and the swim you're in. When I succeeded at the English Channel, I have to say the first half hour, I was like, okay, we'll do another half hour and then I'm getting out, right?
Really? Maybe. Why?
I think I'd remembered the failed attempt the year before and it didn't feel any warmer. It was a little rougher. And I think, yeah, it was just sort of, well, it's, you know.
Do you get seasick because of the waves?
Some swimmers do. I don't. I've been pretty lucky. But you do notice certain differences. I had prepared a kind of a vegetable broth. It was going to be a sort of a comfort food type thing to have every few hours, just because I trained with it in the lake. But the first time that bottle was thrown to me and I opened it, I nearly retched. Just the smell and and that was just the difference of being in salt water. Your body is just sort of having very different reactions, visceral reactions to different smells and tastes. And so, yeah, getting used to that takes a bit of time to sort of find your stride and get your head in that space. And if there are little things like that in the first hour or so, that makes it even more challenging. But yeah, you find a way to get in that groove.
But if you're describing that and that it often is not the most pleasant, I mean, it's a lot of work for sure. How did you get into this? Why do you do this?
Yeah, again, it's a great distraction from my day job.
But you could do, play checkers.
Yes, I could.
You know, you don't have to swim across giant straits.
And I think we talked about this. I was an age group swimmer with the Hamilton Wentworth Aquatic Club. I wasn't a very disciplined swimmer. I was a moody teen. I had a shoulder injury that was really the result of my own sort of mistakes in training and not listening to my coaches. And I grew to just despise swimming and the competition. And I think I was never far from the water. I was a lifeguard through college. I was always sort of near the water. But my wife and I became involved quite seriously in rock climbing while we were in the U.S. And I think that was the first step towards coming back to falling in love with the water, was this feeling you get sometimes when you're just out on a long, moderate wilderness climb. And you know, it's humbling. It's peaceful. You're just sort of doing something physical, and it's a kind of mental problem solving a lot of it. But you're doing it in this setting where it's just, you've got to be responsible. You've got to manage risk responsibly. You've got to manage your team, your friends, your fellow climbers. And you're doing all that against this just monumental beauty that's just sort of so much bigger than you.
Do you believe that there are people? See, I do. I believe there are people who have the psychological makeup to do the kinds of things you're doing, and other people that they could just never. It doesn't matter. There are people who can run forever, and there are people who just hate it from the first step, and they go, "Why would I ever do this?" It seems there's got to be something in you that allows you to do this.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I think I agree in a sort of broad sense. I do think, though, and maybe I push back on this, I think a lot of people, can find a kind of a bliss, a reverie, a thing that really moves them like that, and that there are different pathways to it. And one of the things we do in our swim community with Glow Swimming, with Lost Swimming, with Solo Swims Ontario, and what we do with our trust, the Great Lakes Trust, a charitable endowment, part of what we try to do is get people to imagine themselves doing these things in these places that are often right next to us. You don't have to drive, 4 hours in traffic to get north. It's there's adventures you can have right here. And
I just can't imagine There are people that I just, and myself, I include myself in this. I cannot imagine myself running a marathon because I just think I don't, for whatever reason, have that, whatever it is in me to say, you know, when I'm in so much pain, let's just keep going.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe it's discipline. I don't know. Maybe it's something else. Maybe it's pain tolerance. I'm not sure, but there's something unique.
Yeah. I do wonder, though, I mean, so here's another way we could think of two kinds of people. I mean, I think there are people who are extraordinarily good at becoming disciplined, like Olympic athletes. You talk to some of our top national athletes and our athletes around here, varsity athletes, that they have a gift and a talent for focusing and just really buckling down. But I also think that it often doesn't take much for people to suddenly find something that gets them doing things that a year before they'd have thought, no, that'd be stupid. Why would I do that?
Yeah.
And
next
thing you know, they're on like a tandem rowing across the Atlantic just because they remembered that they liked being, you know, in boats when they were a kid.
We had a guy in here whose name is eluding me right now. I'll think of it probably after we're done, who's a Hamilton guy who solo rowed across the Atlantic. And again, I'm like, you're out in the middle for months, it was. And I just like, I don't, it's a unique thing.
Yeah, and I guess I just wonder if a lot of us do have that lurking in there, and it wouldn't actually take that much.
You know, if you found something.
If you found it.
I mean, I can do a Netflix marathon.
Well,
I don't know if that's exactly the same. Is the reason you do this for the finish line? That euphoria or something when you step back on land, is that the reward?
It certainly is satisfying when you finish. I don't know that.
What is the reward?
Yeah, it's hard to sort of really pin down specific things because every time you remember the mechanics of the actual swim, you say, well, it certainly wasn't that because that sucked. Yeah. It certainly wasn't that because that was really painful. And then afterwards, you know, you touch and then, your mouth is bloated and you can't enjoy food or drink. So it's like, it can't be the
salt water.
Yeah, it can't be the after party.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
So is it just that fleeting moment where, because that fleeting moment doesn't feel like a triumph often. It's just like, okay, we're done. You know, it's sort of...
is it days after when the satisfaction
hits? I think it's a kind of contentment you feel looking back and remembering just the adventure. And again, this is just me, I think there are folks... You know, we share this, I think, this disposition. We're not the competitors, right? We're not out there saying, I got to win this. I got to conquer. I got to triumph. It's more the, hey.
If they did that? Would that be something that you would want to do? Because right now, you had to sign up for the cook
straight,
so that it's very organized and controlled and safe.
Yeah, yeah.
But if they said, we're going to have a five-person race across Cook Strait. Does that entirely change what you're doing and ruin it? Or would that be something you would go, that actually sounds kind of interesting?
Yeah, I don't think it ruins it. And I would probably, you know, if my friend said, come on, we got to do this, then I would, of course, sign up with them. But that wouldn't be the thing where I thought, you know, we got to win this thing, guys.
Yeah. I wonder, you've talked about meditative. I almost wonder if making it into a competition would destroy entirely what you're doing.
For me, it would lose what I think draws me to it. On the other hand, some of the great marathon swims began as races. I mean, there were races across the English Channel. That wasn't the first one, but Toronto, people flocked to Toronto in the 1920s and the 1930s, right through to the 50s. It was a world destination for marathon swim races. And even today, the fastest overall time swum across Lake Ontario. You know, it depends what routes you're doing, but it was a 1978 race that involved John Kinsella, the famed American Olympian and marathon swimmer. And yeah, that was a race, and there were thousands of dollars.
There's a guy from Hamilton. He's deceased now. I was lucky enough to interview him years ago, Claude Saunders.
Okay, yeah.
Who was a great swimmer.
I
think he might have been an Olympic swimmer. I can't remember anyway, but he used to talk about Hamilton Harbor. They would have swims across Hamilton Harbor.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I don't know if I want to do that today. But, you know, we got to run here. We're way late. But it sounds like, from what you're describing, that Senator Edmund Hillary who had that line about why did you climb?
Oh no, it was George Mallory.
Why did you climb the mountain because it was there?
The ill-fated George Mallory.
But it sounds kind of like that's what
he has a bit of that, right? Although it's worth noting he was flippant and frustrated when he said that. He just didn't want to answer that question. Apparently, that was some of the historians argue. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely a bit of that. On the other hand, anything that gets people to have an adventure and to do it, whether it's the competitive urge or whether it is this just weird meditative curiosity, get out there and do it.
Do your colleagues at Laurier, your other professors, because, you know, I don't know why this doesn't sound like a professorial thing to do, but do they think you're nuts?
They are extraordinarily supportive. I couldn't ask for more supportive.
Anyone ever come and swim with you, though? In Lake Ontario when it's 2 degrees?
Not yet. But I will just we have to head off. I'll say one of my Laurier colleagues, a dear friend, Christine Neal in the economics department, was on my Cook Strait swim. She was my crew throwing my ball. And I think whether she'd cut short a conference in Australia to come over and throw the bottle on our swim and to commune with the dolphins.
So, and yes, there were dolphins, and it's a great story. Again, it's in The Spec today. You can read it online at thespec.com. Is the Straits of Magellan then the one you described as a horror show? Is that next for you?
I don't know. Very, very hard swim. It's so cold. My friend did it, and I don't think he ever wants to go back.
Yeah, probably a wise man.
Well, yes, a very wise man. Thank you so much.
Listen, that is Lauren King. If you need some inspiration to do a marathon other than the Netflix marathon, which now I'm feeling like I should probably do. My thumb is very strong. I got very strong thumb muscles from all that pressing. Lauren, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure, Scott.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.